to showcase how a country that is coming out of one of the worst tragedy can use arts and culture to transform itself and to engage younger generation.
Could you take us on the journey of how you got
the thing
here?
That I learned about being a producer, kind of
whatever it's taken to get to this point.
A completely different perspective.
Foul. That's my job.
Producing Heroes, a Circa podcast.
Hi, it's Yaron, and thanks for joining us to meet today's producing hero, Pluen Prim. Pluen was born during the genocide in Cambodia and was raised in Canada. He is proud to have returned to Cambodia and to be a part of the movement to use arts for healing, social transformation, and economic development. Pluen has spearheaded the transformation of Cambodia Living Art from a grassroots project reviving traditional arts to a leading cultural agency in Cambodia. So, Pluen, could you talk us through your background and how you found a love of the arts?
Somehow for me, the relationship that I had with the arts and essentially like Cambodian culture as a whole, it's because of my own personal experience. Having been born in Cambodia and we fled the country with my parents to the refugee camp in Thailand at the age of 3, I was uprooted, lived in Canada, grew up French speaking. So my first language is really French. And then decided to come back here 22 years ago. In fact, my youth has been in Canada and my adult life here in Cambodia. For me, I think it was somehow to find my own culture, my own heritage, a lot of these traditions that I've seen going on around the country, and that discovery kind of been the way I felt deeply passionate about my work and related to artists and related to culture and everything that's going on here.
Were you obsessed by, interested in the arts back in Canada, or was that something that happened after you?
No, not at all. I study business administrations. So no, not at all. I think I have a taste for arts, but I'm definitely not a specialist. But I spent the last 20 years now here, first on my first decade of work, you know, my career started in craft, arts and craft. So I was one of the founder of a huge craft organization here called Artisans d'Encore. And we've worked on helping preserving traditional craft, training young Cambodian and find a market for those products. So I think where my skill is the appreciation of arts, but also I'm really interested to the intersection of social development and social outcome and the work with arts and culture, in fact. So, and also then finding sustainable model for those projects, for finding livelihood for people in the arts or in the craft. Because in fact, I was trained more on businesses, but I've just discovered and been so deeply passionate about arts.
So you obviously have a sage-like tolerance for artists who are not always the easiest of people to deal with. Nam June Paik famously said that an artist should bite the hand that feeds it, but not too hard. How have you dealt with the artist as hand biter if you don't come from the arts?
No, I've been very lucky because I work with amazing artists, you know, internationally recognized like a Cambodian film director Riti Pan, or even work with very local community artists who perform traditional wedding music in rural Cambodia. So I think, for me, it's the same. It's about the human connection. And for me, it's to believe in their vision and the beauty of what they do. So I don't think I have experienced really like a difficult relationship with artists because I'm facilitating their work, but I'm not myself a creator. So I'm more a facilitator to beautify and to help, showing their work. So I feel like very lucky that I've worked with great international artists and also as local artists in their own village.
How do you find balance? How do you find meaning between the international superstar and the local performer?
For me, I think it's about the meaning of their work and the outcome of their work. I think this is what's the most important. You know, you can deal with different personality, you can deal with challenging projects. We've done, you know, as I said, like I think what's really interesting with our work with Cambodian Living Art is we've worked with artists, masters that are, you know, working underneath their home and transmitting an old traditional art form to younger generation. And then we've produced festivals like the one we did in 2013 called The Season of Cambodia in New York City. So I brought 125 artists from Cambodia to New York and all the big venue, you know, Brooklyn Academy of Music, the Metropolitan Museum of Arts, and all of these things. But at the end of the day, it's really about the missions. And it's the same for me. You know, you accomplish that mission on an international stage in the same way you accomplish that mission with your community, engaging just neighbors to come to watch, you know, a puppet show in the village. And it's the same for me. It's really kind of driven by that passion on the missions of our work.
We've had some very major presenters, including yourself, on this show, and everyone has a story, their version of when they had to pick up the mop, where they had to clean the floor or hold the cable in place or tear the ticket stubs because there was no one else to do it. Can you share one or more of your picking up the mop stories?
Well, I deliver food for artists and making sure that they eat well. You know, when we travel, especially, I don't know, it's probably the same for every culture. So the hardest part to travel for artists is food. Because, you know, the cheese and the bread of our the Western part of our world is so difficult for Asian, and making sure that, you know, we feed them. You know, when we did the Season of Cambodia Festival in New York, one of the main thing was also, I remember again, like having that meeting with our producer and saying like, you know, make sure that we have rice cooker for our artists, because that will be one of the most essential things that, you know, if they are well fed, they are happy, they will well perform. So these are the kind of things that, as you said, like the mop work.
And you managed to get the rice cooker?
Yes, of course, with the local community, and they even like make food for the artists. It was really beautiful to see that kind of community engagement with the diaspora community.
It's really true how important food is, and in a way, I think art is a kind of food for the soul, really. So I'm really super interested. I want to get onto this amazing festival, but before we do, can you tell me what Cambodia Living Arts looked like when you first arrived and what it looks like now and what you did to make one turn into the other?
Well, as I said, I think where my skill sets are is around really bringing kind of the social mission of the organizations and making sure that we can build a sustainable model. I begin now, it's 11 years ago, with Cambodian Living Arts. I've just finished also working with my previous organization, Artisans and Core, and spent also a decade there. So in fact, in my career, I had two organizations that I've worked for, and each now a decade. And Cambodian Living Arts was a grassroots organization set up by a friend of mine called Arn Chon Pon, who's a Cambodian-American refugee. We just celebrated our 20th anniversary. So I came after the first decade of work, and the organization was mostly kind of an organization run by the board. So because Arn and the board and friends from America felt the belief and the missions to come and help preserving Cambodian traditional performing arts and creating a vision out of it, the organization, like many more international organizations that is supported by the outsider, trying to work with the insider and trying to create programs. What it looks like now, 20 years after this, is what I'm quite proud of is we've really built the local capacity in Cambodia. In fact, from, you know, a few staffs that was run remotely by the board in the U.S., now the entire organization is based here in Cambodia. The leadership, well, I'm the executive director, but I would say all the managers are also here in Cambodia. And you know, we are now working on our next 5-year strategic plan. But 5 years ago, when we were working on the 5-year strategic plan, what was really interesting is the vision and the mission of Cambodian Living Arts was set up by our founder and the friends back in the US 20 years ago. And now, like 5 years ago, we really looked to create the next vision and mission of Cambodian Living Arts from Cambodia, from the ground, from the work that we are doing with the artists, from our staff and our stakeholder. And I think this is, like I would say, the biggest shift that I'm most proud of seeing the organization really evolving itself within Cambodia, but also with Asia also, because I think in our work, we often look to models in the Western part of the world, and we kind of overlook to what's going on within Asia and within the region. And I think this is where I think Cambodian Living Arts in our 20 years of evolution have really well evolved and developed ourselves.
I'm really interested in your cross-cultural collaborations within the Asia-Pacific region. How did you make them? And particularly because of the focus of this program, as a producer, what are the specific challenges for, first of all, making them happen, and then also for getting them to be authentic, not to mirror voices that come from other places or other models, but to find their own authentic internal kind of courage?
I think I have two examples of that, but I think what's interesting is as we see kind of the shift and South-South dialogue and, like, you know, also financial power shift with Western country and resources and what's going on here in Asia. And especially, like, when you look to Cambodia, like a Southeast Asian country with almost no infrastructure in terms of arts and culture, but still very vibrant arts within community. And also what's really interesting is the youth coming out of a country that is rebuilding itself, and how that young people totally connected to the world kind of aspire to create and express. The shift for me, like two really interesting examples is, one is the festival that I've mentioned, the Season of Cambodia. When we had the idea, in fact, you know, Cambodian Living Arts have been driven by a very strong vision that was set up by the board of directors of Cambodian Living Arts in the early 2000 year, where the board of directors dared to imagine how would Cambodia look like if we do the right investment in terms of the next 20 years and see where Cambodia arts and culture can lend itself as kind of the national and international signature of the country, and not anymore just kind of the image of the genocide, the killing field, or kind of this, the great temples of Angkor. So they did dare to set a 2020 vision, which we are in now. And when we, in 2011, if I remember, the idea of creating a festival abroad was kind of coming out in a way to showcase, you know, where Cambodia is now. You know, what, you know, we've all heard about Cambodia in kind of a tragic way, but we don't know what's the more contemporary story of it and through the lens of arts and culture. So normally, you know, when those things happen is probably an organization in New York or in Washington or in Melbourne or in Sydney would be interested to present or showcase something from Southeast Asia, more luckily something from maybe Mekong region, and if you're really more lucky, something about Cambodia because it's so niche. So our ways to look at it was, how is the mission of this festival can be much more global than just local? So the idea was to try to speak to partner in the US and in New York. And when we decided to do it in New York, is to say, well, you know, Cambodia is a great example of a country that is coming post-conflict, that had one of the worst genocide, 1/5 of the population were killed, and most artists, 80% of the artists were killed because of who they were, you know, expressing, representing ideas, and that's why the regime of Pol Pot killed them. People were really sensitive to the vision and the mission of it. It's like to showcase how a country that is coming out of one of the worst tragedy can use arts and culture to transform itself and to engage younger generation. And then, like, we found a partner, and one of the first, in fact, partner organization was BAM, was the Brooklyn Academy of Music, and I think your friends, Joe Melillo, was the first believer, and I didn't know this big man when we invited him to Cambodia, and at some point he said, like, I understand now, plan your vision, and I'd like to be part of it. I never understood what it meant from that, but what was clear is that there were a power shift where people were interested to our story, not just the performance part of it, but the story behind it. And then finding and building the funding for it and the donor. But then instead of a Western organization coming to pick up what they want, is we were able to propose to those organizations in New York what we wanted and the story we wanted to tell. And that was many people in, like, now friends of mine in New York is telling me that this is a unique model of where, you know, suddenly, like, you're coming to us and you're wanted to tell us your story and we found a way to sponsor it or to fund it. But it's a really different shift of how you present work from a particular culture.
Was there a moment where you were sitting in a meeting and you thought, no, we're going to go ahead with this, and I'm going to kind of risk it. I'm going to stick up for it.
Yes, of course, because in fact, what was really difficult for this project is we had to build the partnership with those institutions and finding the funding for it to happen also. And normally, like, if it was like big country, they will use kind of, I would say, national propaganda budget to showcase, like, you know, like China can do, even India can do, like you do the Indian Week or you do the China Month in New York. We were just a small, tiny grassroots organization from Phnom Penh trying to pull this. And at the beginning, it started with just one thing, and it became bigger and bigger. And as I said, like, it ended up sending 125 artists. The festival was 1 month long, and we had 34 arts venues across New York City. But there was a time where I was like thinking, can we make it? You know, can we make it happen? And I often say, like, you pretend till you make it happen. You pretend till you make it happen, because you don't know if it's gonna happen. But I think what I had is the belief behind the mission, and every single organization and people who have been involved was really driven by the mission of it and what it meant. We took a really traditional puppet, shadow puppet, the big, large shadow puppet troupe from Siem Reap, so a nearby city, town near the temples of Angkor Wat. Those people were used to perform for villagers. They've never had a stage, an international stage for them. And so we've commissioned their work. We've helped them to get them ready to present in front of a Western New York audience at the World Trade Center, in fact, at that time, the World Financial Center. And it was such a big kind of gap between, like, taking people from villages to then showcasing them. But we also were able to showcase contemporary work, traditional work. So it was really interesting to see that mix.
And how did you navigate the often contested space between programmer and producer? Did you find that easy, or was that, did you find yourself?
Maybe because I've never had experience being an executive producer, and probably that's how that kind of, that passion, it was really driven by the passion without knowing what was exactly the work needed to be done. I think really, you know, if I knew, I wouldn't have maybe done it simply.
It's not an uncommon answer. It's a little bit, I think that producing is a little bit like having children. If you knew how difficult it was, you may have rethought it at the beginning, but having gone into it, you realize how much love there is, and you keep doing it. You keep experiencing it, because I find it's not an uncommon answer here, is that it was just a lot more difficult than we ever imagined it could be, but we were too far down the road to turn back.
that's the issue.
So I'm interested to know a few things in more specific detail. I'm interested to know about your relationship to risk. Do you like it? Does it terrify you? And can you give us an example about when you had to take one?
Yeah, I think that's the issue. I think it's because I'm probably like a really big risk taker. You know, the fact that we were able to do a season of Cambodia, no, it's not just about the risk taking, but it's about the partnership. It's all the team that we brought, of course. But there's a layer of risk taking that we took. And we made sure that our board was behind to make that kind of risk. You know, and also just recently, there was another huge production that we commissioned called Bang Sukhol, A Requiem for Cambodia. In fact, it premiered 3 years ago at the Melbourne International Festival of Arts. And again, same kind of scale, not same scale, but it's not a festival, but it was a production. And we're not a producer. We commission important work that we believe into the mission and the vision of the work. I ended up being the executive producer, although we brought a very good producer on board from New York. But again, it's like, because we believe so much in the vision of the work and what that work meant, is we're pushing it further than it can really land. So an idea of a production made by artists of Cambodia suddenly take on the world stage, and we world premiered it in Melbourne, then we showed it at BAM in New York, and then in Boston, in Paris. So this is the kind of work that if you don't take risks, you won't make it happen. But of course, it's not just about taking risks. It's all the collaborator and the people that are involved in it.
One of the things that always amazes me about producers is that they control the budget. They make the program happen. They take the risk. So my real question for them is, why aren't you more famous? Why isn't your name at the top of this in big letters?
The name is not important. I think the work is important. So the work has to be seen. And we don't control. In fact, you know, the reality in our world is that there's no way we control totally control the budget. We never really know where the money will come from and how it will end up. But we just believe that we will make it. And we speak with great friends around the world, and we engage them, and, you know, like, a Melbourne festival is like, why would they present us, you know, and why not other work? And how do we make sure that we make it happen? I think for me, because I'm not a producer, I would say probably like I'm more like a cultural entrepreneur in that sense, like believing in things and just pushing it to happen. And most of the time, I really don't know how it will happen, but we make it happen because we work for it also. It's not like just like idea like this. I think for me, it's, you know, the producer doesn't need to be recognized. It's the work itself that has to be recognized.
I know Joe Melillo very well, and it's the reason why we connected. I'd love you to walk us through the experience of Joe, meeting Joe, him coming to Cambodia, and then how did the conversations knock on till you had 34 presenting partners, and what was the kind of dynamic, and how do you right, surf that wave, and how do you make it happen?
Well, you know, first you have the idea, and we had an idea. The idea of the festivals began with an idea of just making a show, kind of a fundraising event in New York City for our organizations. And we didn't know how the best way to, you know, when you first knock down doors in New York, and you know how it is no one really, you send email and no one really replies. You try to even meet just a program person, and they ask you to send them stuff, but they really never reply. So you also have to find a key. And in this world, and sadly, I have to say, it's a small community. It's a circle. I often say like it's a circle of power, where either you have the best idea in the world, you're out of the circle, your idea would have very big, small chance to get seen. But if you have great, great work, but you are able to get inside the circle, the chance for you to be able to present your work is really strong. And in the world of arts and culture, I've worked for the last 10 years around the world, and luckily, because the work of Cambodian Living Arts and the importance of our work, and somehow our niche is really arts and culture in post-conflict society. We were able to access so many places with the story and the mission of the organization. I would say I was able to access suddenly that small circle of people. And then, you know, you can speak about your idea, you can make it happen. So Joe was among these people who normally you never really get access to, frankly speaking. But what I did is I made an invitation for a presenter in New York to come to Cambodia. I said, like, there's no way I can speak about the work. No one knows about Cambodia. But if you come, spend a week with us, I promise you, you'll see things. And I didn't know what to show because we don't have theater in Cambodia. We don't have really kind of beautiful space to present the work. So I was quite afraid, in fact, to have these people. I had five people from New York that came on our first trip. I got a grant, a small grant. It was $10,000 US dollar from a US foundation. And what I did is to say to five people, I said, I'm giving you $2,000 each as a grant. You use it as you want, you pay your ticket, come to Cambodia, and we take care of you in Cambodia. So it wasn't a lot, you know, like when you think about it. So Joe was among those who responded, came on a trip. We took him on those bad roads across the country. And in fact, he decided to present the Royal Ballet of Cambodia. But the way I showed the Royal Ballet of Cambodia, I was quite nervous because we didn't have a stage really to present it. Those artists were on rehearsal dress, so simple clothing in a school that had no infrastructure, no stage, and really hot. I saw Joe sweating, sitting on the bench, just looking at what we were trying to present. But at the end, he came to me and said, as I said to you, like, Plun, I understand now what you're trying to do, and I want to, the Brooklyn Academy of Music want to be part of it, so we will present the Royal Ballet of Cambodia. But I didn't know what it meant because I was like, gosh, he just saw these people like without costume, no light, no sound, no effect. Why would he want to present it? But I think he was really taken by the missions of what we were trying to do and the story we were trying to tell. And he signed up and, you know, but then we had to raise the money still.
One of the things with Joe is that when he wants something to happen, he's absolutely capable of helping it happen. Are there other presenters in the world who you've approached and they said no, but you've been able to turn that no into a yes? So I'm interested to understand your strategies and approaches.
Well, you don't often have a yes like Joe could commit, because Joe have the power to say yes. When many other people will say, let us check, let us send us the budget, Joe, we didn't even, like, he took me straight there and say, we will present. So I think Joe Melillo has that power to decide where many other people don't necessarily can make that kind of decision as quick as you can and believe in your work, in fact. So that is really powerful when you're just trying to start something and suddenly you have this big man and who's now become a mentor of mine and a friend who believe in your work. Often you have to really work hard to get your budget, get your producer, sending them the things, revise the budget, renegotiate things and look at it. So in fact, most of the time it's the other way around. And you have to work out all the lobby that you need. By the way, I know someone who funded this festival, I know someone who's on the board of this organizations, you should speak to them, blah, blah, blah. So there's huge lobby you have to do all the time. And especially, I would say, because we're not mainstream, you know, who the hell would believe and invest in presenting something from Cambodia where normally, you know, you don't necessarily sure you have the audience that will come with, that will be interested to the work, and are you sure about the quality? Is it ready for an international stage? So we have to, and especially for small country and small culture like us here, you have to really fight for it. You have to explain more than you have to explain normally, and you have to make your case larger than you had to, and you have to come with funding. It's crazy. Like, one of the things in the work that I'm doing is like, gosh, you know, I so many times I had to come with the funding mechanism to present something, you know, in those big halls. And I feel like, and I felt disappointed because I said, oh my God, it's the other way around. It should be, but you believe that these people would invest and would believe in you. But no, you often have to come with the funding mechanism to make sure that your work can be seen.
I'm really interested to know, just looking a little bit deeper into the Season of Cambodia Festival in New York. I haven't had much experience or maybe much luck working with the art museums, with Metropolitan Museum, the Guggenheim Museum. So when you go in for the meetings with them, what is your, do you use the same approach? Do you, as you would with BAM, do you modify it? How do you approach these places that have Giottos and Jackson Pollocks hanging on the wall?
So before really making the festival in 2013, I didn't know much about New York. And I had to build a whole network of friends and people. Luckily, it didn't start from nothing. It started with the board of directors of Cambodian Living Arts, some of our board who were already within kind of New England area, New York and Boston area in the US. But luckily also, Cambodia had attracted many people interested to culture that had traveled, you know, to Cambodia, seen the temples of Angkor, and somehow wanted to stay connected. So from those connections, I've established the relationship. And one of the really fantastic exhibitions we've produced was at the Metropolitan Museum of Arts, like the Met Museum. And what was really interesting is they decided to highlight their antiquity part with the Cambodian sculpture. But in fact, they invited a visual artist from Cambodia to showcase his work within the antiquity gallery. So they brought a really Sopiap Pik is the Cambodian artist who he was from the refugee community and the diaspora community in the US and then moved back to Cambodia. He's doing this amazing, huge, beautiful, rotten sculpture. And we were able to convince the Met with the curator of the antiquities and Southeast Asia art to showcase a contemporary artist and in within the antiquities space. And that was like really amazing that also that the Met did dare to kind of break some of the norm to also mix also contemporary and traditions and present. But of course, the curator was really already passionate about Cambodia, and we brought a gallerist, we brought the artist, and there was a lot of lobby around it. But because the festival had become so big, that suddenly you have the effect of the mass, because then so it's like you want to be a part of it. If you're not part of it, you're not. It's like you just missed something. So that's why at the end, I end up having to say no, because it was just too big also as a festival. But come as one of the first, but was cultivated through the process and decided to be part of it. And the Guggenheim Museum also, but the Guggenheim Museum did a performing arts program. But there were some other visual arts. There was a film festival also at Lincoln Center also.
So you managed to get all the big cultural institutions to play nicely on the same festival. Apart from any individual piece of programming which I think is always a kind of victory. But to get organizations as diverse as the Metropolitan Museum, BAM, Lincoln Center, to participate in the same festival is quite a coup. Do you ever feel that you might inadvertently step on people's toes, that you might break some cultural codes?
Oh, yeah, no, we did. Of course we did. And because, you know, some of them are competing. But as I said, I think what was really, really nice is they all came because they believe on the mission of like this single organization, Cambodian Living Arts, trying to bring a group of artists from different organizations to do it. But I think also you don't believe in luck, but somehow in the whole things is, you know, at that time, the cultural commissioner of New York City, you know, coincidentally was on a trip to Cambodia. I hosted her. Then when I went back to New York, I said, like, I want to do this. So I remember there was a meeting where we gathered all those institutions, and many of them came to me and said, "Plan, do you believe that it's the first time we are all sitting, many of us, around one table?" And it happened. But I brought the the Cultural Commission of New York into the meeting and was co-hosted by her and also the Ford Foundation president, Darren Walker also. So you have two powerhouses, like one is the city and one is like one of the largest funder and institutions in the room. And they said, both of them said, like, we believe in this project and, you know, we'd love to plan to share more about it. And suddenly you have everyone listening and want to be part of it. And it was really beautiful to see that.
So it sounds like in your MBA study, they taught you how to leverage soft power and turn it into real world results.
Smile. I think this is... You have to keep smiling.
You keep smiling. Okay, so that's your trick. And I have to say... Dear listener, that Pluhan has managed to be smiling the entire conversation so far. So he has absolutely works. But smiling is your trick. What else works? Do you bring gifts?
I have my greatest fear before was public speaking. It's something I could not do. But because of that project, I had to do it all the time. So I had to overcome that. Although today I still is afraid, but like that was like one of my worst fears, like to do a speech in front of people.
And not just people, but you just brought the scariest arts organizations in the world into a room in New York and you stood in front of them and you made a project happen. You must go home at the end of that experience and feel like something very special happened that you caused to happen.
Yes, definitely. I think it's something like the larger mission was really about like Cambodia, the arts, but also opening the door for other post-conflict society to believe. You know, what I kept saying is like after that I convinced people that we needed to do a conference and bringing arts leader from post-conflict society to Cambodia and showcase them, like, where is Cambodia now? So we brought people from Afghanistan, from Somalia, from Colombia, from Rwanda. And the whole idea and the whole vision was like, you know, believe it or not, but you've heard about Cambodia genocide. See it here now 35 years after where the country is and where the art is here. And believe that, you know, after the Taliban and after the conflict that you have, you know, if you invest in the right artists and you preserve your artistry and you push young people to express, you know, you can help shape, you know, the future of your country. And that's the message that I believe and I keep saying.
How do those south-to-south conversations go? How does the conversations between countries that have experienced trauma work? Does it produce projects, results, collaborations, or is it only information?
I think what's really interesting is what we wanted to see if there were practices that were in common and experiences that we can share and learn from. And I would say like even inspirations, you know, like when we did it, it was 2017 or 2016, we did this conference in Phnom Penh. You know, we had the Freedom Theater from the Palestine coming. We have Ahmad Samas from the National Institute of Music of Afghanistan coming. And they were, you know, those people are still in conflict. Like they are like dealing with, and for them to be inspired and to see what we were going on, it's also to see that finally, you often think that you are so isolated in your work with the nature of what you're doing, but you don't necessarily think that there's other people that do similar things with you. So that belief and those common practices that can be shared are useful because, you know, it keeps us doing what we do. And from that, for us, you know, one of the things that had come as an outcome of our, you know, like, okay, we did the big thing in New York. Then we hosted this conference. And of course, we do all the other stuff that we do every day. But those are like the big things that we've done. We hosted all these people around the world to Cambodia and to inspire them. And one of the things that I've looked at home also is the rise of nationalism. And I think today, it's really something that is so frightening around the world with the COVID-19 things. But for me, especially because from a country that almost lost its culture because of the genocide and ideology, when you revive it, there's these things about us. So then suddenly there is also a rise of nationalism, thinking that, oh, our art is the best, our dance is the best, our culture is the oldest one, blah, blah, blah. And I was really afraid that, in fact, what we were trying to do would go the opposite way and would not necessarily help society. So one of the things we decided to do also 4 or 5 years ago is to start looking at regional exchange and regional collaborations. And of course, the idea of doing an Afghanistan Living Arts or Rwanda Living Arts was something people said, like, oh, you should model your things. And but who we are to try to model is so much different context, different culture, different people. And so this is not the way I wanted to see things and we wanted to see things. But more collaboration within the region and bringing some of our arts administrator and artists to see works with Vietnamese, you know, our neighboring country and Thailand and Laos. And in fact, we realized by creating more regional exchange and regional program that most of our country often look to the West. And so there is, and also because of funding, there's much more opportunity for artists from Thailand to go to Paris or to go to New York or to go to Melbourne than is for a Thai artist to work with a Cambodian artist or a Vietnamese artist to work with a Laotian artist, or to allow a festival producer from Hanoi to go to Vientiane to see another film festival also going on. So we initiated 3 years ago a project called the Mekong Cultural Hub. And the whole idea is really to create and foster more a cultural exchange collaboration within the region. So that idea and the nationalistic idea and perspective is so, and especially with your neighboring country, Vietnam and Cambodia has historical issue. Thailand and Cambodia had, recent issue. So how do we open that up and how do we create that? So this is one of the big outcome. And I would say, as we look to our next 5-year strategic plan, is really what we want to do is it's squarely center ourselves within Asia, but also much more pushing regional development.
And what's your advice? I mean, we in Australia often talk about the next century, this coming century, as being an Asian century, that the shift of economics, of power, of geopolitical influence is moving towards Asia. And we don't generally understand it very well, particularly culturally. We see it either as kind of exotic or strange and a bit scary. Obviously, that's part of what you do, is kind of engage and demystify. But what about on the reverse? So there'll be producers listening to this thinking, hey, I'd love to do some work with a Cambodian company, or I happen to run a circus. I wonder what the circus world is in Cambodia. And I'm interested in two things. One, how do you make contact? And how do you make sure that that contact isn't colonial and isn't a domineering form, but is genuinely ally and exchange?
It's a good question because, again, it's like often it's driven by the resources, like the financial power of being able to send, send a choreographer or send a stage, any a director or anything from more like a wealthy country or culture or institutions. I think what's interesting is there is more and more platform within Asia that allowed meeting. Like I've been to one in Korea, in Japan, don't remember all their name, TPAM, CAMS, all of this. So it's interesting that there's more and more of this, but it's recent, I would say. In the past, we would go to ISPA, APAP in New York, or again, like in Australia, you have also something like APAM also. But now there is more and more of that. So in nature, like collaboration is very difficult to be at the same level. It's like in nature, it's very difficult. But again, I always focus on why are we doing it? And I challenge that all the time when I bring artists to collaborate together. Again, the example of Bang Skola Requiem for Cambodia is a good example. The initial idea came from a Cambodian composer. We brought then a Cambodian filmmaker, but along the way, we wanted to get it ready for an international stage. And And you said, like, how do you create connection meaningful? But I've met this Stephen Armstrong from the Melbourne Arts Centre in Yokohama during one of these sessions, kind of where people meet people. And I started speaking about the vision of the project. And then I said, what if you come to Cambodia to see it? And he said, I've never been to Cambodia. But I think the process of making the work and meeting the people is so important. And that's why I think, like, it will be challenging in this virtual world that the in-person meeting and the feeling of what we're trying to do is so crucial to collaborations. Stephen Armstrong said, Plan, I have an idea. I think you should bring a stage director to work with you, and then he proposed at that time Gideon Obazanek, which I didn't know Gideon before. I didn't know how Gideon was also quite a big star in Melbourne and in Australia. But then, like, you have a few superstars who try to work together to do a collaborative work, So how do you make it, like, who will lead what?
It's a very Stephen approach, isn't it? Stephen's got such a glorious kind of interest and generosity towards people. He wants to bring them together all the time. There's not a lot of I think the world would be a lot better place if there were a lot more Stephens and Joes.
And I think, but then you build out of it. But I didn't know Australia before all of these collaborations. So I think the good things is, like, in our world of art, there are so many good people. Because I think we're not only driven by commercial production. There is still many risk takers that believe in fantastic work that has depth, content, and vision of it. So this is the lucky part of what we do and the work that we do. And because I'm not a producer, I'm not trying to produce things all around the world just to produce, but we do meaningful work.
I would say you're probably closer to the essence of a producer than many, because what producers do in my mind, and the reason for this podcast, is they make things happen that wouldn't happen without them. And if that didn't happen, then the world would just be a poorer place. We need to wrap this up, but I have a question for you, which is, I'm interested, when a young producer comes and says, what lessons do I need to learn? What can you teach me? What's your advice to them?
I think one of the things I've learned in my work is the connection is so important. Like, you go to conference, you listen to people, you want to get to know their work more. It's only the way we were able to do what we, like, what that was one of the main things we were able to do is we built a network of people that trusted us, that believe in us, And each time we then brought a project, it's not just easier, but people just kind of listen differently to what we are doing. I think for young people who start is be curious. I think, there are so many interesting conferences, discussions that are going on in this world of arts and culture in different ways. I think you have to get to know what's going on there and learn, because it's the only way then you reach out to the people that can make your work seen and believe in investing on you also. So because I, like, 10 years ago, I didn't come from a cultural background. I had to learn everything from scratch and I get to know also everybody that way. But as I said, like, it's a small circle. When you get into the small circle, then you can move things.
Well, yeah, but having people like you who have a sense about the people who are on the outside of the circle makes it a much less small.
Yeah, I bring the people outside of the circle into the circle. Yeah,
that's a beautiful thing to do. Look, it's been an absolute pleasure. Is there anything else you'd like to share with our listeners?
Well, I think in this time of COVID-19, we are all now in another phase of, there's not going to be a norm. We're not going to go back to a normality. So, like, for us, we are continuing to invest in young leader, young artists, because I think it's like part of the solution is through imagining and expressing. So I think, again, like, Cambodian Living Art had worked as a post-conflict context, but this is another post-conflict context for the world. So I hope that many of us who are interested in arts and culture can be part of it.
Yeah, no, that's beautiful. And I was thinking a similar thing as you were talking earlier. You have some lessons in post-conflict that may be very applicable to the rest of the world, and that perhaps what does emerge in the future may be inspired or helped by some of the lessons that you guys have learnt and can share. So I look forward to seeing what happens next.
Thank you.
I'm Yaron Lifshitz, and you've been listening to Producing Heroes, a Circa podcast produced by Lauren Isinger. If you've been listening on Apple Podcasts, please consider writing a review. And if you like what you've heard, you can find us on social media at Circa Contemporary Circus, #ProducingHeroes.